G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It's time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth2u.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, mate.
How are you today, Jono?
Doing very well. Very excited because finally we're in Job chapter 38 and 39, Ira, because everything changes here. Finally, this is where Yehovah replies to Job.
He certainly does.
He does. And I've got my new King... No, I've got my new King James study Bible open. I've also got my new JPS open. And I really like the study notes on the JPS. And it's interesting because 38, chapter 1, it says, "Then Yehovah replied to Job out of the tempest and said..." And the note on that in the new JPS, it says, "Replied to Job," literally answered Job, with Job marked by the definite accusative particle et as direct object of the verb.
Okay.
I'm just telling you that's what it says. I'm just throwing that in. I thought that was interesting.
You did?
Yeah, I thought...
Do you think anybody other than me understands what you just said?
I couldn't help it because... I'm sorry. Just to explain to everyone, there's an enormous amount of hype. Would we call it hype?
Yes.
Over the word et, which is spelled alef tav. In fact, there's a whole Bible that highlights, most Christian Bibles highlight Jesus' words in red. Apparently, there's a Christian Bible, a Bible including the New Testament, that highlights the et. It's called the Aleph Tav Scriptures, and everyone's excited about it ever since, because somewhere in the New Testament Jesus says, "I am the Alpha and the Omega," but of course in Hebrew that would be, "I am the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the end. I'm the beginning and the end." Actually, Yehovah says that in Isaiah, but then everyone went, "Well, you know what? There's this word. It's et, and we have no. It doesn't mean anything. Why doesn't it mean anything? Because it doesn't mean anything in English." But it actually means something specific in Hebrew, and it happens to be used here in the first verse, and so my JPS notes were just pointing that out.
But the interesting thing is that, this whole issue and the hype about, the Aleph Tav and this word et, which, people talk about in Bereshit, the idea of Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim v'et ha'aretz, and the fact that, the et is untranslatable, and they try to make it, the fact that it's, speaking about Jesus, as the Mashiach being shown right in the first verses. What's interesting is that if you're going to make an argument like that, then you have to take every instance of the identifier, et, that worked in the Hebrew, and it would have to match that. You would have to see that would be true all across the board for the thousands of times that we see this direct identifier that shows. What I think is also very interesting about this, and it just so happens that I happened to be studying this the other day because somebody actually contacted me. Somebody contacted me through the Torah Threads website and asked a question about the first verse in Genesis. And what's interesting is, from a Jewish perspective, one of the great commentators, Rashi, teaches that this doesn't even speak of the order of creation, which sounds kind of crazy to most people because, of course, it sounds like this is absolutely about creation. And, I know we're talking about Job tonight, but because you brought it up, there's actually a linguistic impossibility in the very first word in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, Bereshit, okay? Because there's no noun attached to it. A word like Reshit would never be attached directly to a verb. It would be attached to a noun. So we would see, like, for instance, in the famous verse, fear of Hashem is the beginning of wisdom. Reshit Chachma, the beginning of wisdom. So you see that noun attached to it. Actually, in Hebrew, if it was really, if you really wanted to be linguistically correct, Rashi says it would be Bershona, okay, would be the way to do that. And the reason why he says it doesn't, present the creation order is because it says that the Ruach Elohim merachefet, hamayim, right? That the spirit of Elohim, the Ruach Elohim hovers over the face of the waters. So the water was already there, is the point.
So it's so appropriate that we are speaking about creation because really it does tie into what we're about to read. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. And I have a little note here on chapter 38 that says, hey, go back and read Genesis 1 verses 1 to 10 before you read this. And so maybe, you know, listeners, by all means, pause and go and do that because it really does tie in.
The other really interesting thing is in verse 1 is that we do have a note as it relates to the Masoretic text, you know, the Masorah on this, as it relates to Hasarah, you know, this word that's translated as a tempest or the storm, you know, which actually in some translations is the whirlwind. And the only other time, I thought I would just throw this out, the only other time that we see this in the Tanakh is in 2 Kings 2, when Eliyahu is taken up to heaven in a whirlwind.
Oh, taken up into heaven. There's another conversation. We can't go down that rabbit trail right now. You know, that is interesting. That's interesting.
Sorry, taken up in a whirlwind. If you don't like heaven, taken up in a
whirlwind. It's not that we don't like heaven, but we...
Yeah, but you know what?
I know what you mean. Verse 2, my friend, continues like this. Who is this who darkens counsel? Wow, that's pretty harsh to begin with. Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Man, kicking the guts straight away from Yehovah to Job. Now prepare yourself like a man. Man up is what he's saying. Is that what he's saying? He's saying man up and I will question you and you shall answer me. I'd want to crawl into a little hole right about then. I just want to crawl into a hole in the ground, cover it over and say, sorry.
Actually, a really good translation of this would be gird now your loins like a man.
And gird now your loins like a man, not man up.
Right, but it's man up in a way because what he's basically saying is, like a warrior, prepare yourself for confrontation.
Someone told me to man up the other day. I thought that was interesting because the person who told me to man up didn't have a beard. I thought, you know, you should at least grow a beard before you say that to people.
Right. We could do a dual translation of this. And what I mean by that is it can have two different meanings because this idea of girding can also mean putting on a belt. Remember we talked about Job earlier on about the fact that he makes comments about not even being able to wear a belt, not even be able to wear clothes because of his condition. And so in a way, I think we see a double meaning here in that, you know, God is basically saying to him, gird your loins like a man, I'll question you and make it known to me. So he's basically saying, like a warrior, prepare yourself for confrontation, but also at some point be prepared to be healed to once again be able to gird yourself, to be able to wear
it. Oh, sure. Good point. Okay, potentially. Verse 4. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or to who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, Ira,
uh-oh,
and all the sons of God shouted for joy.
Uh-oh.
Now that's, I don't think we have time to get into Mormon theology, but...
Well, if you knew Mormon theology, I guess you could. I don't know.
Well, no, correct me if I'm wrong. Are you familiar with this? Because I think it's this verse where they, if I remember correctly, I could be wrong, and I apologize to the Mormons out there if I've got this entirely wrong. But you and I, last week, I think we talked about in Isaiah where it talks about, quote-unquote, Lucifer, or the morning star.
Right.
And as you pointed out, somewhere in Revelation, it refers to Yeshua as the morning star. And here, it all comes together for them in chapter 38, verse 7, when it says, the morning stars sang together. And so somewhere along the line, Jesus and Satan were are alien brothers or something like that. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but I do remember looking into it once and it was highly amusing.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, the Hebrew here is, you know, kochvei, you know, and kochvei actually is literally talking about the stars, okay? It's not some spiritual meaning here related to stars. This is literally the stars. It's like when we... You know, when we read in the Hebrew, kochavim, you know, stars. You know, related to when we see stars come out. Like in Judaism, for instance, you know, sundown, you know, really comes for us when there's kochavim. And the reason why it's plural is because you have to be able to see three stars, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's what it's talking about there. It's not some spiritual thing. And this is really related to some of the things that we saw. Believe it or not, you know, when we saw the speeches of Elihu, we're going to see some very similar language in chapter 38 and 39. you know, which would very strongly, you know, speaks to us of the possibility that Elihu really was a mediator, you know, between God and Job. And so when it talks about the morning stars sang together, when we look at the imagery that we saw in previous chapters about, you know, the gold coming out, you know, as a result of sunlight and the moon and things like that, the imagery that Elihu was painting about God, you know, and the majesty of God, we're just seeing that same kind of thing in this verse.
Sure. Who shut the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? Wow, there's some poetic description. When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and when I fixed the limit for it and set the bars and doors, and I said, this far you may come, but no further, and here your proud waves must stop. That's awesome, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, think about that. The womb, you know, this place that God set all these waters. You know, you and I discussed it briefly when we talk about the clouds and the clouds' ability to contain this amount of water. That how in the world could it happen, you know, unless, you know, God was doing this, and this is what he's saying. He's saying, not only do I have this ability, you know, to hold back this water and to let it forth when I desire, but then I set the seas and the oceans. I mean, think about that. I mean, you were just at Bribey Island. You were going to the beach. What stops that water from?
Oh, I know. But God does this. He has the power to do this, and He says, and so I say to the waves, so that your proud waves, you may come this far and no further, here you must stop. Have you commanded, he says to Job in verse 12, have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken from it? It takes on form like clay under a seal and stands out like a garment. From the wicked, their light is withheld, and the upraised arm is broken. The upraised arm. The upraised arm. Now, remind me, that appears in Numbers chapter 15, right? The man who sins rebelliously or presumptuously did so with an upraised arm.
Sure. And that's, you know, it's talking about a level of haughtiness here. You know, when we look back at these verses, you know, I love this poetic kind of language, and I love the imagery that it gives us when it talks about, you know, having the morning come and that it might take holds of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. I mean, because the purview of the wicked is nighttime, is darkness. They do it when it talks about this seal, you know, it's changed like clay under the seal and its features stand out like a garment. You know, the same way that clay takes on a different appearance after it's stamped with a seal, the earth takes on a new look when the dawn comes and clothes it with light rather than the light of the darkness of night. And of course, the wicked are afraid of light because it uncovers them, which is what it's talking about. From the wicked, their light is withheld and their uplifted arm is broken. Those haughty enough to show themselves in the daytime will be broken, is what it's saying. Like, you know, you're wicked during the night, but the daytime shakes you out. If you're haughty enough to show yourself in the daytime, show your evil in the daytime, you're broken. You're haughty.
Your upraised arm is broken. Have you entered the springs of the sea, or have you walked in search of the depths? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Where is the way to its dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place that you may take it to its territory, that you may know the paths to its home? Do you know it because you were born then, or because the number of your days is great? He's basically saying, were you there at the beginning?
Yeah, and I love verse 19, because verse 19 could really be a question of, do you understand the concepts of good and evil? And that's always a question comes up. And, you know, we talk about that in Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 45, where we very clearly see that God creates all things, including evil. A lot of people always argue that point. Well, God is not evil. God didn't create evil. Really? Well, that's not what the Tanakh says. God says he creates all things, including evil. So he says, where is the way to the dwelling of light? And where is the place of darkness? So do you know, Job, do you know where good resides and where evil resides? Did you do all these things? So it really is a question of the creative power, of God. you know, and basically, in other words, I, God, am the one who controls this. I am able to uncover the abode of both the good and the evil with the idea of the sun coming forth from darkness and so forth.
This really has the, you know, at the beginning I said, you know, that God's telling Job to man up, and he really, really is. I mean, he's expecting a level of incredible maturity from Job, and he's expecting Job to be a man, but so much of religious expression, particularly in, well, let me just say the tradition that I came from, Ira, we want God to baby us, and we want God to take pity on us and to feel sorry for us and to come and sort of help us through gently. But here, we just don't see any of that.
Well,
we don't see that at all. What we see is that he expects us to be men. He expects us to be mature. He expects us to get on with it.
You know, look, there's a certain thing to be said about the fact that sometimes we let things come out of our mouths, forgetting that God is always there, always watching. You know, sure. There's actually a famous story about, I think it's Vilna Gaon, who was one of the famous sages in Judaism, and he saw his wagon driver was getting ready to steal something, and he said, "You better be careful, somebody's watching." And a wagon driver got all freaked out and took off. And his assistant said to him, "Who was watching?" And he said, "Hashem. Hashem is always watching."
Mm.
And that's the thing. The thing that happens is that God is confronting him in this way because he said some very powerful things. He made very bold statements in the midst of this divine council, you know, with everybody listening, with God listening, with the divine council, you know, with the Melachim, you know, listening. He wanted to confront God. I want to stand before God. I want to bring my argument. And God is saying, okay, here I am now. Bring your argument.
Mm.
But first,
so he goes on and says in verse 22, "Have you entered the treasury of snow, or have you seen the treasury of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble," he says, "for the day of battle and war? Mm-hmm. By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth? Who has divided a channel for overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolts, to cause it to rain on land where there is no one, and a wilderness..." That's interesting. "To cause it to rain on land where there is no one. If a tree falls in the forest, doesn't make a sound. And yet God causes it to rain on land where no one is there to know that it's raining. A wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste and to cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass. Has the rain a father?" How's that for a question? Has the rain a father?
Are we trying to finish up to chapter 42 tonight?
Come on, I'm on a roll. It's difficult to stop because it just flows and it's just so incredible to read.
I know people like to hear your beautiful accent. You know,
yeah, I have a beautiful accent.
And one day what we should do is have you hired to read the Bible on cassette so people can listen to in the car.
How old are you, Ira? Did you just say cassette?
But I think they want to hear us expound on some of the verses as well, Jim.
Go on. What do you want to highlight there?
No, I just want to go back for a minute to 23, where it says, "which I have reserved for the time of trouble or distress, for the day of battle and war," just to kind of give people a hint as it relates to this, where we see a situation like this in Joshua 10,
verse
7, in the battle of Gibeon against the five kings, where God rained down large stones and hailstones.
While they were retreating, mind you, the enemy were retreating, and in their retreat, he pummeled them with massive hailstones.
Right. And this could refer to the future as well of Gog and Magog, as well related to that. And when we go forward, I mean, it just really is amazing stuff. We know these things. We know the things that God says are true about him. But sometimes when you just hear it in this way, and certainly when you hear what he's saying to Job, it's just, looking at verse 29, "From whose womb did the ice come forth, and who has given birth to the frost?"
I know. "Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb does the ice come, and the frost of heaven, who gives it birth?"
Yeah.
So poetic. The waters harden like stone, and the surface of the deep is frozen. Can you bind the cluster? Now, here we are. Now, you touched on this the other week. Can you, we're going to talk about this. So, can you bind the cluster of Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? That's verse 31. It goes on to say, can you bring out Maseroth in its season, or can you guide the great bear with his cubs? Do you know the ordinances of heaven? Can you set their dominion over the earth?
Right. So we looked at this in chapter 37, verse 9. Originally, mm-hmm. It says, from its chambers comes the whirlwind and cold from the scattering winds of north winds. And we talked about that this idea of scattering winds or north winds actually could be translated as constellations, which was then supported by chapter 38, verse 31 and 32. And what we talked about when we looked at 37, verse 9, is the fact that when it talks about, can you bind and bonds Pleiades or undo the cords of Orion? Can you lead out constellations in times and seasons and lead the bear with her sons? You know, talking about Ursa Major and Minor are the bears, and then Pleiades is the seven sisters, and it's a star cluster close to the earth and most visible by the naked eye. Which, going back in context, and remember, context is king, folks, when it comes to looking at the Tanakh. We just saw that idea in the early verses about Kochvei, you know, or the Kochavim, the stars, you know, singing, along with the divine council. This is the same thing that's happening here. This Pleiades, these seven sisters, are the stars that we get to see with the naked eye. So that when you go out at sundown and you look out, especially on a night like tonight, where, you know, at least in the traditional Jewish calendar, I know not according to the sighted moon, but according to the traditional Jewish calendar, it's Rosh Chodesh Elul. So if you're going to go out, that's what you would see first. You would see this Pleiades, is what we're talking
about. Now, listen, that this brings me to another topic, and we won't dwell too long on this. Mazel Tov. Now, we see here in 32, can you bring out Maseroth? It's the plural, right? Is it saying constellations? Mazel Tov. Tov is good. Does that mean a good constellation, a good star sign?
Well, it's actually a different root. It's a different root completely.
Is it really?
Yeah.
So it's not related?
No.
So what does Mazel Tov mean? What does it say?
It really means good luck or good fortune or whatever. And it's you know, there's some questions as to whether I prefer to use a term like Bahatzlacha, you know. Although Mazal Tov or Mazel Tov is a typical traditional Jewish thing to say, you know, I mean, do you really want to wish somebody good luck? I mean, you know, or good fortune. Hatzlacha means with success.
Beautiful. So there's a better alternative. Thank you for that. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? Can you send out lightning that they may go and say to you, here we are? Oh, the lightning says to you, here we are. Mm-hmm. Who has put wisdom in the mind, Ira, who has given understanding to the rooster? Now, you know, I love this because one of my favorite films, of course, is Fiddler on the Roof, where Tepier is talking to Perchik, and he says, as the good book says, when a poor man eats a chicken, one of them is sick. And Mendel says to him, where does the book say that? And Tepier says, well, it doesn't exactly say that, but somewhere it says something about a chicken.
It's very true. And that is typical Yiddish humor and Yiddish wisdom.
I love it.
You know, we're used to that. And I'm glad that you appreciate that. Most people look at that and go, huh?
It's hilarious. But what is it? Does it actually say rooster? Because if it does, this is where Tepier is referring to. This is the only place in the whole of the Tanakh that says something about a chicken.
And where do you see this?
Well, this is 38, 36, right?
And you think it says chicken there?
Well, I don't think it does. What have you got?
It says, Misha batuchot chachma o mi natan lasechvi, I'm sorry, lasechvi bina. Or Vina, I'm sorry. Who has put wisdom in the inner parts or given understanding to the mind?
So why the rooster?
I don't know. Where do you have
rooster? Let me tell you. The rooster. This interpretation, now these are the notes in my new JPS. This interpretation is reflected in the ancient benediction with which the prayer leader begins every morning service in the synagogue. Praised are you, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who gave understanding to the rooster to distinguish between day and night. The source of this benediction is in Berachot 6b, right, which states that this benediction should be recited each morning upon hearing the crowing of the rooster. Do you know, that's one of my favorite sounds. At the moment, we've got three roosters, and one of my favorite things is just in the morning, you know, in my sleep, when they start crowing. I just love that.
And what it is it's one of the what we call Berchat HaShachar, the morning blessings. And it starts off with Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam Asher Natan Lesech Vivina. You see that? It's like the same two words that we just said at the end. Lesech Vivina.
In fact, you know what? Even in the NIV, it's
Yom Uvein Laila. And basically what it's saying is, blessed are you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, who gave the heart understanding to distinguish between day and night. So there is no rooster there either.
There is. Well, now, the NIV, interestingly enough, says, who gives the ibis wisdom or gives the rooster understanding?
Right. And so what this is, you know, what it is they're going to more of another level of interpretation on this. And certainly when you're talking about Berachot 6b, you know, you're going to be talking about sometimes what's called an agadic or a midrashic interpretation on the Talmud, you know, where in the same way, you know, not to go into a whole discussion on Berachot, but we see the issue of Berachot when it goes to Kochavim, okay, related to the stars. In other words, Berachot starts out with the laws of Shema, on the idea that Shema talks about, that we say the Shema both in the morning when we get up, and we say the Shema at night, Kochavim, mm-hmm. the stars in the Mariv, in the evening prayer. Mm-hmm. And they say, where does this come from? And it comes from the idea of two verses. One is in the Shema itself, where it says, Ushaspacha uvkumecha, when you lie down and when you wake up. Mm. And it also, they point to Breshit, where it says, and there was evening, there was morning, the first day, Yom Echad. So they use those two verses to do that. When you take it forward, so the evening they describe is related to Kochavim, and Shachar is going to be at dawn, correct? Mm. So when you go to Berachot 6b, and you, what they're doing is they're expounding on, in the same way that they're saying that we say the Shema when there's Kochavim, when there's three stars, they would say the same way that we know that the dawn comes is based on the wisdom of the rooster, that God imbued this wisdom to the rooster to know when to, you know, when it's true.
Now, by the way, there is one other verse that does have a rooster in it, but I'll just because I said it's the only one in Job. It's actually Proverbs 30, verse 31, a strutting rooster, a goat, and a king at the head of his army. Now, that's what it says pretty much in the Holman, the English Standard Version, the New International Version, the New American Standard Bible. They all have rooster. In my New King James, however, it says a greyhound, a male goat also, and a king whose troops are with him.
What verse is that again?
This is Proverbs 30, verse 31. You know, because a greyhound and a rooster, they're easy to get confused, right? Actually, there's an asterisk there. There's an asterisk there, and if I go down, it says, yeah, exact identity unknown. Yeah, no, so they're not so sure. They're not so sure if it's a greyhound or a rooster. What do you reckon?
So it's interesting because the Halot, you know, the Hebrew Aramaic lexicon of the Old Testament, has rooster. But the JPS, of course, has the greyhound.
Yeah.
Not the
It has the greyhound as well.
Well, the JPS, not the new JPS, but the JPS. But I want to see further what it says here, because it's the Hebrew word zazil. Boy, that's a tough one to pronounce. And so I'm looking at some of what they're talking about here. So Jesenius, which is another one of the respected lexicons, has greyhound. They alternate with... So I think what's happening is here nobody really knows, because I see some calling it a migratory locust or a cricket. Some translate it as rooster.
So it's a little bit obscure, but you know, like Tibia says, we got two to choose from. Somewhere in the good book it says something about a chicken. There's a couple of choices for you, dear listener. 37, it goes on to say, who can number the clouds by wisdom, or who can pour out the bottles of heaven when the dust hardens in clumps and the clods cling together? Can you hunt the prey of the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young ones, the young lions, when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Who provides food for the raven when its young cries to God and wander about for lack of food? Chapter 39, Ira. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? I do. Do you know why?
Why?
Because I just got a buck. I just purchased another buck for my three girls. And as soon as he was off the truck, he was into it. Boy, was he having a good time. So I know when they're going to kid.
Right. So the thing is that we see a change here now from some of the natural things that God talks about, you know, the stars, the morning, the sun coming out, the, you know, the lightning, the thunder, the hailstones, the ice, the snow, all those things. And now he goes into the whole animal world. And one of the things that we see here is that in the past, Job has made the argument that God does not really concern himself with what goes on in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
God now continues to show him that not only do I control all of these things that somehow to us would seem impossible and supernatural, but he even maintains these kind of things, the times when goats, mountain goats, will bring forth calves.
Yep, 5 months.
Maybe
a little bit less now. Yeah, I'll let you know when it happens. Or can you, I'm looking forward to it. We haven't had goat's milk for ages, and I love goat's milk, so that's
a
blessing.
For?
What's that?
What I can't wait for is, and you know, I think you've tried it. I mean, you weren't there to try it, but I think you got it in one of the stores on your trip to Israel, was the Zimmermann goat yogurt.
Yeah, I did, from Itamar.
Yeah, and so, you know.
Oh, it was good, and it had strawberries in it.
Yeah, Rabbi Moshe is my rabbi, you know, and he lives on Itamar. He's the mayor, and so, you know, that's like going to be one of the first places we stop, and I want to get a tour of the Zimmermann farm so I can get it like fresh right there.
Oh, it was good stuff, too, and I was missing my kefir. And I was a little bit disappointed that I wasn't going to be able to get out to Itamar. But when I saw it in the store, I thought, hey, goat's milk yogurt from Itamar, this will do. And boy, it was good. So make sure, dear listeners, when you go to Israel that you try some of this. Even better, go like Ira will be doing, go to the source and get it fresh. That's the best way to have goat's milk yogurt.
And true, if any of your listeners, you know, on that note, if any of your listeners really would like to go visit Itamar, all they have to do is contact me privately. They can contact me through the Facebook page or through the Torah Threads website, and I'd be happy to set them up with Rabbi Moshe Goldsmith.
Excellent. Can be worked out. TorahThreads.com, right?
Yep.
There it is. So it says, do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young, or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill, or do you know the time when they bear young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring, the young ones are healthy, and they grow strong with grain. They depart and do not return to them. Oh, boy, that just reminds me of another one of my favorite things. I mean, I do love the rooster crowing in the morning. Another thing that I love is when the goats do kid, because one of my favorite things to watch, Ira, and it blows my mind every single time, is the first thing it does is it stretches, it gets its balance, the kid it eventually stands, and the first thing it does is it goes to find its mother's teat.
Mm-hmm.
It's just spectacular. But it goes on to say, who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the, what's that, onager? Onager?
Yeah, wild donkey. It's basically two different words used for the same type of animal there.
Okay. Whose home I have made in the wilderness and the barren land its dwelling. He scorns the tumults of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver.
You know why that is? Because what it's saying in verse 6, basically, is that this wild ass, this wild donkey, does not allow itself to be domesticated and will never work for anyone except for a god. When he scorns the tumult of the city and he hears not the shouts of the driver, it's actually the root there of that driver is actually the same root for to oppress, and it's really talking about a slave driver. In other words, he has free reign in the domain that I've given him. I've given him the wilderness, the barren, you know, the salt flats and so forth, and that's his domain that I've given to him, and he doesn't pay attention to anybody who would try to domesticate him or be a slave driver over him.
He does not heed the shouts of the driver. That reminds me, of course, of Numbers chapter 22, Balaam on the back of his donkey, and the donkey would not heed to his wishes to go straight ahead because Yehovah's messenger was a satan to Balaam. But we don't have time to go into that now, do we, Ira?
No, but if people know about that, we have a very good teaching that they can listen to called Hell, Hades, and Hasatan by our friend.
Hell, Hades, and Hasatan by our friend Yoel Ben Shlomo. And I don't think we touched on it in the first couple of chapters of Job, but we will be touching on it. Jason's Spiritual Babies and myself, we're going to be touching on that soon in a series on Satan. Just a short little coverall over the Tanakh on the topic. So that'll be interesting. There's something for the listeners to look forward to. So stay tuned. Now, where am I up to?
We did talk about it, by the way.
We did. There you go. Find in the first and second chapters of Job. Verse 8. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. No doubt he does. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger?
Manger?
I got manger. What do you got?
No, it really is related to a feeding trough.
Oh, okay.
But I just love that they put manger in there.
That's so reminiscent. Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes, or will he plow the valleys behind you? Behind you. Will you trust him because his strength is great, or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor?
Yeah, another wild animal that you're not going to domesticate, that basically, you know, is going to do what
wild ox.
Yeah. Depend on it to do what you want it to do.
This is an interesting one. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are her wings and pinions like the kindly storks? For she leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without concern because God deprived her of wisdom, Ira, and did not endow her with understanding.
Right. So what God is bringing forth here is the idea that only God's providence protects even these unborn little birds, because they leave the eggs. You know, they leave them, and it can be trampled, it can be broken, but it's God's providence that protects them so that the species continues.
The ostrich is not extinct, even in the absent-mindedness of the mother,
right.
that God still provides for her young.
Right, and he's basically saying, I didn't give this particular bird, you know, great wisdom and understanding and intelligence to take care of their young. I take care of them.
I take care of them. And how's this for a segue? In 18, he says, when she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and its rider. Do you know there's people that ride ostriches? There's ostrich races in some places on the earth. I've seen them.
And what's interesting about that is when you go back, when you said flap proudly, I actually would translate that as flaps wildly. And so what it is I love this verse, because when you think about this, if he gave this bird wisdom and understanding, he says, else she would soar on high to mock the horse and his rider, meaning that basically even a foolish bird like this is able to outwit man.
Mm.
You're so proud and so arrogant, Job, you know, but I made this stupid bird basically that it could even outwit the horse and rider by mocking them, you know, as they fly over.
How fast. But then it goes on to talk about the horse. Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed its neck with thunder? No, I'm not happy with that. What have you got?
Huh?
Have you clothed its neck with thunder?
Thunder?
You got thunder.
You get these translations. Like a Half-Price Christian store or something?
Well, to be fair, Ira, it does have an asterisk there, and you go down and it says, oh, or a mane. And I'm thinking, what, you had a choice between thunder and mane, and you chose thunder?
Or a mane. I like the way you said that, too. Or a mane.
But, you know, I love it. I mean, has anyone ever stopped and thought about the horse with the mane down its neck, and when it runs and the mane flows? They're so majestic. They're so magnificent to behold. He created them like this. He says to Job, did you clothe its neck with the mane? Can you frighten him like a locust?
Can you frighten him like a locust?
What have you got?
Do you make him quake like the locust? Do you have an asterisk there too?
No, I don't even. It just says that. His majestic snorting strikes terror.
It actually can. Oh my God, it's like ridiculous.
This is the New King James.
It's basically, it could be quake or quiver. Do you make him quake or quiver like the locust, his majestic snorting terror?
Yeah, that makes more sense.
And what this really relates to is when you look at the next verse, for instance, which I'm afraid to ask you what yours says, so I'm going to read it.
It says, he paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms.
Okay. He paws in the valley and exults in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. Yeah. And so he basically, what it's talking about is, you know, when a horse digs in, I don't know, like, I love the Middle Ages. You know, I was a history buff when I was a kid. I loved studying world history. Yeah. And I loved that period of the Middle Ages. I love movies like that and so forth. And I don't know if they do this in Australia, but here in the United States, they have what's called Renaissance festivals.
Mm-hmm.
Where you go and they have these big parks and they're set up like the Middle Ages.
We went to one recently when we were up at Bribie Island. There was one at Caloundra, I think it was.
They have jousting?
Yeah, they had jousting and we went and saw it.
Perfect. So this is a perfect example of that. You know, when you see the jousting match, you know, the guy up on the horse may be afraid, but those horses fear nothing. I mean, here these guys are coming to each other, all armored up on these horses with the whatever they call those things that they have for the joust. And what you see is you see that horse lower its head.
I'd love to see that.
Right? Did you watch
jousting on horse on dogs?
That would be pretty funny. Dog. We might have just invented a new sport, Jodo.
Something you'd expect to see monkeys doing in a circus. Jousting on dogs.
Jousting on dogs.
But you're right. No, when I was watching it, they were, they had to almost settle the horses and get them, you know, to go down the right track because they were so keen. It's like, let's do another one. Come on, let's go, let's go, let's go. They were really keen to fly down and get into jousting.
Right.
And it goes on to say, and he mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage, nor does he come to halt because the trumpet has sounded. The blast of the trumpet, he says, aha! He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting.
Right, and that's true of horses. When did you ever... I mean, you think about... I think of all this imagery, like even movies. Did you see the movie War Horse?
I don't think I did.
Great movie, you know, very moving.
Uh-huh.
But it's about this horse that's actually this young man's horse, and it might have been even in Australia. I don't remember. I mean, it was either England or Australia.
No, when we think of horses, we have the man from Snowy River.
Yeah, so this horse was just he had this horse. It was the horse that they had on their farm for plowing and everything else. But during the war, they needed all these horses, so they took this young man's horse and they put it into battle. And you see this horse just without fear whatsoever. You know, became a war horse, became, you know, just, you know, each person that ended up taking this horse into battle, it just showed how it wasn't afraid when the trumpet sounded. It wasn't afraid when cannons were going off and so forth. And that's very true of horses. And this is what I'm saying. I instilled this in them. I was the one who prayed for this.
And I have to, now this takes me to one of my favorite poems, and I'm just going to have to read it here because it's one of those, it's just a horse moment, really, Ira. There was movement at the station, for the word had passed around that the colt from Old Regret had got away. It had joined the wild bush horses. It was worth £1,000. So all the cracks had gathered to the fray, and all the tried and noted riders from the stations near and far had mustered at the homestead overnight. For the bushmen love hard riding where the wild bush horses are, and the stock horse snuffs the battle with delight.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah.
It actually
it's so cool.
Sounds like it actually sounds like the horse and war horse when you read that.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's just one of the greatest poems ever. And a lot of people would have seen the movie, but this is the poem where the movie came from by Banjo Patterson. So look it up, people. It's a wonderful one, particularly if you like horses. So it goes on to say, in verse 26, we're getting near the end of this. Does a hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command or make its nest on high? On the rock it dwells and resides, on the crag of the rock and the stronghold. From there it spies out prey, its eyes observe from afar, and its young ones suck up blood. And where the slain are, there it is.
It's actually because where it says eagle, it could really more be speaking about vultures here. You know,
yeah, really.
When it talks about his young ones suck up blood, where the slain are, there is he. But you know what's interesting is I want to go back I don't want to go back, but I just want to say a couple of things, you know, before we end here for the evening. And what I think is really interesting here is that here we have God finally speaking from out of the whirlwind, as we saw in the very first verses. And it's very interesting at this point that no mention is made of the heavenly court again. No mention is made of the Satan's demands against Job. There's no explanation given for his suffering. And
it really doesn't. It doesn't answer the question, does it?
Exactly. We saw here in these verses that not even once does God address the burning issues of the protagonists in our story, and that's namely the suffering of the righteous versus the tranquility of the wicked. He doesn't deal with that at all. You know, how is all of this that we read, the vision that is laid out by God, supposed to really help Job in his predicament? You know, and I want to go back and I want to read something that Please. May kind of give us a little understanding as a, you know, maybe a possible answer. This actually is from the writing of Rambam, Rabbi Moses ben Maimon, you know, who's also one of the great Jewish sages. And he wrote in something called Yosedei HaTorah in chapter 2. This is what he writes. He writes, "We are commanded to love and to stand in awe of God. And now we are, and he says, and how are we to obtain this love and fear?" Okay. He says, "When man considers God's deeds and his wondrous creatures, apprehending through them that God's immeasurable and boundless wisdom, immediately he will be filled with love, praise, and exaltation, longing deeply to know more of this great God. This, as David wrote, 'My soul thirsts for God, my living Almighty,' Psalm 42:3. And then he goes to say, "And when he ponders these matters further, he immediately recoils in awe and is filled with terror at the realization that he is nothing but a tiny, lowly creature, smothered in darkness, standing in utter ignorance in the presence of the all-knowing. This, as David said, 'When I see your heavens, that which your fingers wrought, what is man that you should take heed of him?'" Psalm 8:4.
Wow. And actually, that brings me to it, because I was quite it really captures it also in the study notes of the new JPS. It says, "God will not give Job a straight answer to his demand for a hearing. If the reader is looking for God to explain why bad things happen to good people and how justice reigns in the cosmos, neither God nor the book of Job as a whole provides an answer. If the message of the book is construed as a question of virtue, whether a person should be righteous even in the face of apparent injustice, no answer would be expected, nor would it be appropriate. If the book poses the question of why the righteous suffer, then the conclusion may be that we cannot know the ways of God, and that to insist that God act in a certain way is to limit God's great power and knowledge. The effect of God's speech is to put Job in his place, to awe him of God's great might."
Yeah, and so here we have all these questions, right? Where were you? Have you ever ordered? Have you considered? Did you did you ever penetrate? Would you undertake? Would you be able? Do you understand? Do you give orders or dispatch? Are you prepared? Can you fathom? And the question is, does God really want him to answer the questions? And the answer is no. Instead, I believe, and I'm sure you would probably agree with me, that this is just part of the overall crushing inquiry by God in the very first question. Who is this that darkens counsel?
Yeah, I think I do agree with you with that. Absolutely. And like I said, it really does make one want to crawl into a cave and cover it up with a rock and say, "I'm sorry, just go away now."
Look, and even you and I, think about it, as we were reading these two chapters, and even in the, you know, the brief time that we had together, how it affected us reading the poetry of God and the awesomeness of God and the things that he does, and yet we have not suffered in the way that Job has. And God forbid we ever should, or any of our family ever should. But if it awes us in that way and makes us seem so small in God's sight related to that, you know, how must Job feel at this point?
Well, we find out, because next week, Ira, it does continue. I'm going to read the first couple of verses, because it says, "Moreover, Yehovah answered Job and said, 'Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it.' Then Job answered Yehovah and said, 'Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I'll lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice. but I will proceed no further. And it continues from there. We're going to talk about that and get into chapter 40 and 41, I do think, Ira, if we can, next week. And we're coming to the end of it. My goodness. Thank you, my friend.
I mean, what are we going to do after that? That's going to be, we're done.
We'll have to think of something else to do.
Okay, Mike. It's a pleasure as always.
Pleasure to have you. Ira Michelson, and once again, the Facebook page is TorahThreads.com. Also, Torah Threads on Facebook, Treasures from the Tanakh on Facebook. You'll find those pages there. So like and engage. And until next time, dear listeners, be blessed to be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.